Okay, if we can begin, we've got three bills on the agenda. I'm going to take them out of order. The first bill, and this is more procedural, because I'm not sure how it got here. Senator Skoy will explain. House File 3167, Senator Skoy. So we don't have a division report, do we? Right. Okay. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the House File, the House Tax Bill was referred to Finance because its companion, Senate File Number 2726, the Reserve Bill, of which Representative Len Chesky is the author in the House and I'm the author in the Senate, was here and did not get referred to taxes when we did reserve. Your reserve bill got referred to taxes and this one did not. So it was referred to the Finance Committee, and I'd appreciate it if we could send the House tax bill to the Tax Committee.
So if everybody understands what's happened, as Senator Skoy indicated, remember we had toward the start of the session, we had the two reserve bills, Senator Skoy's bill, my bill, and we sent one of the bills to the Tax Committee, which was then incorporated into your omnibus tax bill. But the air bill was still here. It's the companion to House File 3167. So it's as simple as that. We're not here to debate. As much as we'd like to debate tax policy in the Finance Committee, that's...
Well, Mr. Chair, it is the House tax bill, so I wouldn't be any help in explaining it anyway.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, do you need a motion?
Senator Thomasoni?
You need a motion to move it to taxes.
Yeah. Okay, I'll so move. So Senator Thomasoni moves that House File 3167 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Taxes. Senator Dibble.
Sure, I just thought I'm very glad we have the bill in front of us. I appreciate that very much.
You're welcome. Okay, on that motion, all those in favor? Senator Pappas?
Never mind.
Okay, so we're not... I don't have a copy of the bill.
We're not passing.
Again, we've got the bill here. The intent, remember, this was a companion bill that came over, and Senator Skoy needs the tax bill in the Tax Committee. So we're not... Senator Pappas?
I guess since we're not really going over the bill, it's just a technical motion.
It's a procedural
motion. Do it without recommendation. Because that way, we haven't really looked at it at all.
Senator Thomasoni, would you?
I'll incorporate that, Mr. Chairman.
All right. So Senator Thomasoni moves that House File 3167, without recommendation, be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. Is there further discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? No. Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Skoy. All right. The next, we have another House file that's been in the committee and obviously some discussion about it. Senator Hayden is here.
Too boring for them.
Well, I'm very tempted to go to the next bill if we can't.
Yeah. Sure. I'm here now. We can start. Oh, I thought you were waiting for me. Save him.
That's over with already.
You did it already.
All right. Here's Senator Hayden. Senator Hayden, we thought you got lost somewhere in the building.
Oh, I got kind of caught by the social workers, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah. Some of my favorite folks.
So we have House File 2091. This has all happened fairly quickly. The bill is going to be used for, members might have read about this agreement on the minimum wage bill. And so we're having distributed a summary prepared by Mr. Fuller from Senate Counsel, which is the Delete Everything Amendment. That amendment's being distributed, the A6 amendment. Now, this bill's already been heard in Senator Pappas's committee, so this is not an author's amendment. Senator Hayden, I guess what I'm going to suggest, just procedurally, you would like to have this Delete Everything Amendment placed on the bill. So the bill we have in front of us is not going to be anything we'll work from. Is that correct?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. We actually have incorporated the underlying bill into the A6 Delete All Amendment.
Okay, I guess what I'm wondering, that being the case then, what we probably should do is move the amendment, and then that'll kick off the discussion. If people want to move to amend the amendment, for instance, that would be in order. So Senator Sieben moves adoption of the A6 amendment. So Senator Hayden, on the A6 amendment, if you can indicate what we have in this Delete Everything amendment.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. As we're all aware, the minimum wage discussion has been going on at Capitol these 60 months. We've had opportunity to hear from Minnesotans in a variety of constituencies, labor, small business owners, low-wage workers. So I'm pleased to move forward. To the bill, Section 1 is the underlying bill, which allows for the expansion of existing law related to donated sick leave. As it is currently written, state employees may use donated sick time to care for critically ill spouses and dependents. If the spouses are dependent, passes away, they become ineligible for the use of the sick time. So Section 1 allows for 2 weeks of sick time to be used while planning a funeral or grieving following the death of a family member. It was passed in the House unanimously. So that's the first section in the underlying bill. The next part of the bill defines small and large businesses. This is the actual minimum wage portion of the bill. It defines small and large businesses with a reference to $500,000, making it easier for employees to know what their wages are, and also the Department of Labor and Industry to enforce wage laws. Following that bill outlines new minimum wage laws for large employers. In August, the minimum wage will increase to $8 per hour. August of 2014. In August of 2015, the minimum wage will increase to $9 per hour. And in August of 16, the minimum wage will increase to $9.50 per hour. Next, the bill outlines wage increases for small employers. In August of 2014, the minimum wage will increase to $6.50 an hour. August of 2015, the minimum wage will increase to $7.25 per hour. And in August of 2016, the minimum wage will increase to $7.75 per hour. Subsequently, the bill outlines the wage increases for the training wage. The training wage is a wage that may be paid to those under the age of 20 in the first 90 days. The training wage will be increased to the same rate as a small employer wage. Next, the bill for youth wage at the same rate as it increases for small employers. The bill also raises the wage for J-1 visa holders at the same rate it does for small employers. The final section of the bill authorizes the Department of Labor and Industry to determine a percentage increase for the minimum wage based off of the implicit price deflator, try saying that three times, for personal consumption expenditures not to exceed 2.5%. Finally, beginning in 2017, no later than September 30th of each year, the commissioner may issue an order that an increase not take effect. Members, this is the final piece to address the concerns that have been aired about inflationary increases being on autopilot. The commissioner may look to leading economic indicators when making this determination. Following the suspension of an increase, the commissioner may make supplemental increases in addition to the annual increase of that same year, so the rate is equal to the rate that it would have been in effect if the suspension had not occurred. So, Mr. Chair, members, thank you for your time, and I ask for your support of the bill and stand for any questions.
Sir Hayden, let me ask a question, not trying to cause trouble, but in looking at this language, it happens very rarely, but what happens if you end up with negative inflation?
So, Mr. Chair, I think We have some folks from the Department of Labor and Industry that might be able to help us with that portion of the bill and the language that we put together. Well, Mr. Fuller had pointed out in line 3.16, a minimum wage rate shall not be reduced under this paragraph. So he's saying that, if I listen to Mr. Fuller, that it would not go down. Is that right?
No. Okay. All right, that answers my question. Other, Senator Fishbach.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to and publicly state how disappointed I am that this came to this committee the way it did. There's no public notice. It's being attached to another bill. Sure, the bill was properly 3 days in advance. Notice was put out there. But to have this, and this is different than, this is the agreement, the conference committee agreement, I guess, or whatever you might call this agreement, that was just announced this morning. So the public had no notice that this was coming. I didn't know this was coming until the rumor mill and, started ginned up and people found out an hour or so ago. I don't know if the DFL members of the committee knew before that or what had happened, but it's really disappointing that when we're making this, and these are changes in what originally started out in the Senate bill, and so I just, like I said, I wanted to publicly express my disappointment that this is the way we're handling major legislation like this now, and I'm assuming that the reason we're tacking it onto another bill is so we can ram it through and get it onto the floor tomorrow before the public has an opportunity to digest it and make any comments on it.
Senator Fishbach, I guess I would suggest just a couple of things. Senator Hayden, as the author of this bill and as a member of the conference committee, can speak better than I can as to procedurally what's happened within the conference committee. But let's say it had followed the process where this is some agreement that had been reached and had been placed in front of the conference committee, there would not be necessarily a public hearing. The conferees might have simply adopted this language, passed the conference committee report to the floor, and the fact that we can actually have some committee debate, even limited, is a lot more than would have taken place with a change within the conference committee. So there's more of an opportunity here than if this had happened just within the conference committee process.
Mr. Chair, there hasn't been a conference committee meeting for maybe Senator Hayden can help me out, but it seems like a little while ago now. So this wasn't necessarily something that was even discussed. I take that back. There was lots of discussions, but this specific proposal was not even discussed in the conference committee. The conference committee never took it up. That's the process. And I appreciate the fact that we're in committee now looking at it, but there was no public notice. So the senators can discuss it, but, the general public has no idea that this is here today, other than if they had the opportunity after work started to take a look at the press conference.
But Senator Fishbach, the point I was trying to make was that if this had all been handled within the conference committee process, there would be no more notice, in fact, less notice, less discussion, and less debate. The six conferees, and Senator Hayden can speak as to what's taken place within the conference committee. I'm not close to this conference committee or what's been going on, but they've been, I think, Senator Hayden, you've had, a number of meetings of the conference committee?
Yes, correct? Sir, Mr. Chair. We had a number of conference committees, and we weren't getting anywhere. And ultimately, as we started to have negotiations there, in particular, the provision around the Commissioner of DALI and what we're calling the off-ramp and the J-1 visa is something that was relatively new to the process. There were a couple of things that ultimately made people feel comfortable that precipitated the process we're in today.
But Senator Hayden, and correct me if I'm wrong, there was a lot of discussion within the conference committee process about inflation and whether the discussion centered on some of the absolute particulars of your A6 amendment, the conference committee had some lengthy conversations about inflation and what might happen. So, Senator Fishbach, what I'm suggesting is that hypothetically, if Senator Hayden, I'm not sure who was involved in the process of the promulgation of the A6 amendment, but let's just say hypothetically Senator Hayden, as a member of the conference committee, had come up with this, had bounced it off of other conferees, and everybody said, great idea. It could have been presented to the conference committee and adopted within a few minutes without necessarily any debate on the part of the conferees, anything else within the conference committee. So I'm just suggesting that even though you're viewing this as an expedited process, I'm suggesting that if it was done simply through the conference committee process, there would be nowhere near as much discussion as we're going to have right now.
Mr. Chair, if it had been handled in the conference committee, the public would have been put on notice that the conference committee would be meeting. Thus, they would know that the minimum wage was going to be discussed. There's no evidence in any of our postings for this committee that the minimum wage would be an issue. At least if they had handled it through the conference committee, people would have been on notice that it would have been discussed. So whether or not this exact proposal would have had all the discussion we may have, the public would have known what, or at least the general parameters of what would be discussed. This agreement or this amendment, whatever you want to call it, this was negotiated largely behind closed doors, and now it comes to us here as an amendment to a bill in finance committee. The conference committee hasn't dealt with it. So I just, again, Mr. Chair, I'm disappointed in the way we're handling this, and I think that the public deserves better, that they should be notified. And in addition to that, we have recessed a committee so that we can deal with this, where we have constituents from all over the state sitting there waiting for their bills to be heard. And I just think that the way that we've handled this is a disservice to the public.
Okay. So the objection's been noted, and I think that's a very good point that Senator Thomas Oloney's committee is in recess. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to express my disappointment to see this amendment here today. I came to the committee this afternoon expecting to see Senator Hayden's bill involving the vacation donation to sick leave. And I had taken a look at it before we came in. And I will tell you, Mr. Chairman, that until I got here this afternoon, and I would say about 15 minutes ago, I did not know that this amendment was coming up. And I suspect that at some point today I'm going to be asked to vote on this. And I will tell you, Mr. Chairman, that I do try to look at bills before they come before the committee. I try to understand them. Sometimes I fail, but I do try to understand them. And until 10 minutes ago, I had never seen this language before. So I'm going to have to try and figure out on the fly what the percentage increase in the rate of inflation as measured by the implicit price deflator, national data for personal consumption expenditures as determined by the United States Department of Commerce, Bureau of Economic Analysis. I'm going to have to try and figure out what that is. Because I got to tell you, Mr. Chairman, I don't have a clue. And yet I'm going to be asked to vote on this. And my disappointment, Mr. Chairman, is that you allowed this to come before the committee this afternoon without giving us any kind of warning. And I just disagree with procedurally with going about that. I know that you're going to, in all likelihood, this is going to pass out of the committee, and I can't do anything to stop it. But I've got to tell you that I think I have a right to know what's in the bills before they come before this committee. And generally, I think you've done a very good job in protecting us in that respect. And today, by allowing Senator Hayden to offer this amendment, is a complete failure in that regard. And I just wanted to express to you how disappointed I am.
I appreciate that. And certainly, my response, and Senator Newman, you're correct. In terms of how you've handled yourself, whether in this committee or other committees I've served with you on. So I understand some of the concerns, but we get the opportunity to have a fuller debate, as I mentioned to Senator Fischbach, than might have been taken place within the conference committee process itself. But Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your point would be much better much more well taken if the time on this amendment wasn't 9:15 this morning. I found out about this at 1:15, 4 hours later. The only reason that I can think of to not let anybody know for 4 hours is to try to slip it in under the radar, which is, to Senator Fischbach's point, the public didn't know. Now, if someone had emailed this out at 9:30 or even sent some sort of message to my office, we could have notified people that might have an interest in watching this, might have an interest in supplying information for the pros and cons of this particular proposal. Your point, Mr. Chair, while valid, doesn't carry a whole lot of water. I do have a question, Mr. Chair, for the author.
Certainly no.
Senator Hayden, this is the Finance Committee, and we have a fairly significant amendment here. I don't have a fiscal note or a local impact statement. You're not the author of the bill, but you're on the Conference Committee. Does the other bill have anything of that sort with it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nienow, I don't off. I'm looking for a little bit of help on the fiscal note of the bill that was in the Conference Committee.
And certainly, Mr. Nauman's looking as well. Mr. Rakowski?
I'm John Rakowski with the Department of Labor and Industry. Members of the committee last year, in House File 92, there was a fiscal note. The House version did have an annual index for inflation, and our cost was essentially for the mailing every year to employers, and I'm sorry, I think it was between 50 or 70,000. 70,000 comes to mind. So that would be every year.
Certainly no.
And would the language that's in this amendment here in any way impact that up or down, or would we assume it's the same?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nienow, we would assume it's the same.
And Mr. Chair, I'd appreciate if we could have that before we come to a vote.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr.
Chairman, I join in the protest regarding the actions of this committee today. We had a House file scheduled, Senator Hayden's bill, on state employee sick leave, and now we are being faced, as has been said, with an amendment that has a significantly different issue. Matter of fact, a completely different issue. If this were a bill in order to follow Senate rules, we would have had a 3-day notice. Now it's being added on to a completely different bill. We have rules in the Senate, not necessarily for our benefit, for the public's benefit, so they can get a chance to know what we are doing for or perhaps to them. And they have a right to have that lead time. I'm not going to add too much more to the comments of other members, but I believe that this is really a step beyond the pale, Mr. Chair, of taking an issue like this that's so significantly different than the underlying bill, and bringing it forward as an amendment, whereas in any other case it would have been a bill with a 3-day notice following Senate rules.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hayden.
I did get a little bit of information of the bill that my good friend from Dolly was talking about did have a mailing requirement, which was in the 70,000 range. This bill or this amendment does not have that requirement. So as it stands today, there would be no cost.
Mr. Chair, then why is it in the Finance Committee?
Well, the original bill had been referred to the Finance Committee.
Mr. Chair, with all due respect, we don't have the original bill.
And
in front of us.
And as everybody knows, we don't have a germaneness rule relative to amendments in the Finance Committee or any committee. Other Senator Sieben?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if Senator Hayden could, if members are concerned that they don't have enough information, perhaps Senator Hayden could just go through some of the some additional aspects of the bill or the amendment that's before us. It seems to me, Senator Hayden, that the minimum wage will increase to $9.50 now in 2016. Obviously, that rate was different than originally passed off the Senate floor, but $9.50 was a dollar amount that was talked about in the conference committee pretty extensively. Indexing is now included in this amendment, and Senator Hayden, you touched on that earlier, but again, that was discussed pretty extensively in the conference committee. It seems to me that something that may be new is this, what happens if there's a downturn in the economy. There is language in this amendment that would allow for the Commissioner of Labor to put inflationary increase on hold for a time being if these economic conditions are met. That seems to me to be the piece that's pretty new that maybe wasn't as extensively talked about in conference committee, but seems to be sort of I thought it was a pretty smart compromise to make to have that language with the Department of Labor, because we had heard concerns from members of the Senate who were concerned about putting the inflation on autopilot. Well, now with Senator Hayden's language here, there is this ability for the commissioner to put that on pause. So, you know, I understand the concerns raised by the minority here, but I think that if we can continue to discuss the substance of the amendment and turn back to that, perhaps people will get more comfortable with the language. Also, I just mentioned that I see a lot of folks in the room who have represented both sides of this minimum wage discussion, and so I think that, you know, we have the time here to have a more thorough debate on the language that's before us.
And Senator Steven, relative to that, and I think this gets into some of the concerns expressed. You know, we talk about, you know, the public not having knowledge, whether it's this bill or any, or 99% of our bills. It's not as if people are going to all of a sudden get in their cars and head down to the Capitol. It was my intent to at least offer the opportunity to anybody who'd like to testify for or against the amendment on the record to present their position, representing folks both, not a parade of people, but people both for and against the A6 amendment. So that's my intent, Senator Sieben, to try to offer some of that. Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I'm echoing my colleagues in the way this is done and the way this amendment was brought forward. It almost reminds me of the way the $90 million Senate bill was brought forward in the bill last year in the Tax Committee, and there was really no notice of that happening until all of a sudden it came to the floor. And so this is a similar type situation, and I'm very disappointed.
Okay, you know, I wasn't going to get into this, members, but I'm forced to comment, not just in response to Senator Anderson, but let's just remember, you know, sometimes things happen around this place where issues take an unexpected turn. I do recall in 2011 when the entirety of the state budget was put together, not simply without public input, but literally behind locked doors. The entirety of the state budget was put together in that fashion during the shutdown, the special session and so on. The entirety of the state budget. Senator Peterson.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, is it your intent to take this bill up on the floor tomorrow? Is that the reason why you're doing this this afternoon?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson. I think that the path, if it's the committee, is that it leaves here, and I'll always look to staff because sometimes I get a little off on where it needs to go next. So maybe someone on the staff can help us. If the bill leaves here today, it would, I think, travel to the floor. Good. So it would travel to the floor, but I think that we wouldn't be able to take it up until Wednesday, is my understanding.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, you know, I think we all walked in here with an agenda that I think literally was going to maybe take 20 minutes or so, and I would have to point out that from my perspective, this whole idea of combining bills into larger omnibus bills, taking an issue that's very non-controversial and combining it with one that is something that I think Minnesotans are really growing tired of, you know, in my view. What was your motivation in terms of combining these two bills? Did you have, is it solely just to get it heard this week? Is that it? Or?
Senator Hayden?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, I think that, if I may, you know, we've been talking about the minimum wage for about a year now. And so we went through this process last year. The conference committee got called on the last day of session, and so we weren't able to. I'm on the conference committee with the original kind of concept with Senator Tomasoni and Senator Eaton, and so we weren't able to get things done on the last day of session. And then we started out this year having a conversation in public with a lot of testimony to talk about what we thought the best way would go. Ultimately, as part of the process in negotiating and in a very open way, we were able to come to a compromise, which is kind of before you today. But because there are some substantially different items in this than what was in the two bills that were in conference, and once again, staff can help me, there is a House rule specifically, I think, that states that the issue of the J-1 visa in particular, which hadn't really been talked about, and then this off-ramp around the Dolly commissioner and that language, those were things that we thought we would bring back, have this conversation that we're having now. I imagine we'll get to that and then start to move this forward. But I will say, even though I know that there is a lot of protest, and I respect that, that the issue of the minimum wage and it being moved up and how we're going to calculate it over time and if it's good for business or bad or retailers or good for people, all of those things I think have been thoroughly talked about over the last session, over the interim, and the greater part of this legislative session. So I think today was a day in which there was an opportunity to put this compromise together and then bring it back to this committee and then have another robust conversation, I'm sure, on the floor if it's this committee's purview to pass it.
Thank you. Mr. Chair?
Senator Peterson.
Yeah, I think, I just heard Senator Hayden not express any explicit desire that this needed to be heard this week yet. In fact, he even referenced a couple substantial differences in this amendment than what was in the original bill. And based on the arguments I have heard, I feel like it's certainly appropriate to delay this, and I'd make a motion to table the bill.
All right. We have Senator Peterson's
roll call,
motion
please.
To table. Roll call has been requested. It's non-debatable. Clerk will take the roll, and the chair votes no.
Anderson. Bonoff.
No.
Champion.
No.
Dibble.
No.
Fishbach.
Yes.
Goodwin. Ingebrigtsen.
Yes.
Latz.
No.
Limmer.
Yes.
Lori.
No.
Miller. What's Newman.
This? Yes.
Nino.
Yes.
Pappas.
No.
Peterson.
Yes.
Saxog.
No.
Sieben.
No.
Stumpf.
No.
Tomasoni.
No.
Westrom. Weger.
No.
Anderson. Goodwin. Miller.
On a vote of 7 yes, 12 no, the motion fails. Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to add to the conversation that there's discussion about when this will be on the floor, and I think that assuming that this passes out, Senator Bach and I talked earlier about this bill possibly being on the floor on Wednesday. So just so that we're clear that seems to be the path we're headed in right now if this moves forward. And I just point out again what Senator Cohen said, that although this language was attached to Senator Hayden's bill, again, Senator Hayden was a member of the conference committee, and there certainly will be time for the public to weigh in prior to the prior to us taking up on the floor on Wednesday through this hearing process here today, and because it was announced in a very public manner this morning in a press conference, and the governor has since released a statement saying that there was an agreement reached on the minimum wage bill. So I think it's more fruitful to spend our time debating the merits of the legislation that's before us rather than the process. So to that end, Senator Hoffman, could you just maybe give us some background information on, like, what this legislation, what it means for the working people of Minnesota, and how many thousands of Minnesotans will be positively impacted from increasing the minimum wage, or, you know, other statistics like that that you want to share with the committee? How many women? I know that the minimum wage increase will disproportionately help women in Minnesota. Some of those types of things to help refocus our conversation, perhaps.
Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben. I most certainly can. You know, some of the things that we have talked about over this past year that I'll reiterate is raising the minimum wage to $9.50 an hour would improve the income of 357,000 working Minnesotans across a Democratic spectrum. There's an estimate of about 63% of those are women, and a lot of those are women with children, as we would know. It would increase annual consumer spending power in Minnesota by $472 million. And it would also give a much needed boost to sales at local businesses. Indexing the new $9.50 wage to inflation would help ensure that wage would maintain its value over time, as opposed to falling behind the cost of living. You know, some people asked, and I know it got asked as we took the bill through, why $9.50? When Minnesota established a state minimum wage in 1973, it was $1.80. If you index that rate to inflation or to some sort of economic indicator, it would be $9.52 today. I think that that's important because I've been asked why the number. How many people would be impacted by the minimum wage rate of $9.50? Going back to July 2012 to June of 2013, 352 people held minimum wage jobs that would be paid less than $9.50. You know, Mr. Chair, Senator Sieben, I can continue to read through some really, really great talking points if that's what the committee would suggest, and things that I know that we've heard. But, you know, I think that this state and low-wage workers in the state really deserve a raise. I would also say, because I say this a lot and I say it to Senator Champion a lot, when we talk that this is the floor, we are continuing to want to make sure that people are paid well in this state and they're paid related to the work and the productivity that they have. But we think that as we look around over the years, that $9.50 and making sure that people can at least keep some of their buying power is a really, really important notion in this state. And so those are some of the reasons in which we're bringing it forward. And once again, what you see in front of you is a lot of hard work with a lot of people involved trying to figure out how we do this in a way that keeps low-income workers, which I care about all workers in Minnesota, but as you guys know, I do a lot of work with low-income people, and the least among us, and I think that this is very helpful for them.
Thank you. And I indicated a couple of minutes ago that because we're dealing with this amendment for the first time, is there anybody who wishes to testify on the amendment for or against? I wanted to offer the opportunity for people if they wanted to do so. I know there's been talk about the public not having a chance for input, so I wanted to make the offer. I don't see any takers. So, Senator Westrom.
Well, Mr. Chair, to the prior points made, maybe you can clarify for me. Generally, you've tried to keep your committee to finance and not bringing big policy changes into bills, but is that something I'm just imagining was happening in this committee, or is there a transition or a change, that a paradigm shift that we could count on? Can you comment on that to the earlier concerns that were raised, and then I have a follow-up?
I think the paradigm shift took place with the B amendment of Scott Senator Dibbles on Thursday night was the paradigm shift. Senator Westrom, you know, we try to limit discussions to finance issues. Obviously, this has an indirect finance. It's not so indirect, but you'll have agencies, for instance, local governments that will hire people at lower wages, seasonal employees, for instance. And so to that extent, you know, there are some issues that relate to budgetary kinds of issues in terms of public employment. You have some other issues. Senator Hayden talked about some cost in terms of mailing, which is now going to be, which is not to be considered. At one point, there was some discussion about that. So I think there's some certainly tangential fiscal issues, and this committee has dealt with a host of bills. We've got some bills coming up this week where the fiscal issues are not at the forefront of the bill. So this one has some indirect fiscal issues. I made the offer to testify, so I'm sorry. You were kind of hidden behind the column, yeah. And so I apologize.
So, Mr. Chair, if I can just finish.
I'm sorry, Senator Westrom, sure.
Mr. Chair, I guess just a comment, and now I guess the loop has been closed. Some of us ought to feel hoodwinked, and I think it's getting a little beyond what Republicans or the minority can trust at some point. And I specifically remember hearing the announcement on the floor today by Senator Bach that we've got the Finance Committee has a bill or two we need to briefly get up to the Senate for a hearing, so we recessed, and so here we are. Not dealing with a small bill or a narrow-reaching bill that looked like it was on the agenda prior to session today, but instead a deal that seems to be coming from behind closed doors, and others have mentioned that. And so I mention that because at some point this place works on trust, and everybody tries to be congenial and workable in the process, but what was represented to us on the floor and why we were recessing in the Senate only to come back and hear some bills that the Finance Committee were kicking out, this is a major change. And so I guess I join in the concern that was expressed by what's going on here with such limited notice and what seems to be a what happens when you got mob rule or one party rule, and that I think the public needs to know this is what's going on, and so I think it could have been handled much better and not in this fashion. But Mr. Chair, I have a question for the author, and then we can get to the testifiers. Senator Hayden, we talk about fiscal notes, and you were talking about the only fiscal cost that you were made aware of so far as the mailing of 70,000, that then you just erased the requirement of mailing. Can you explain to us what the mailing was going to do that we're now not going to do to small businesses across the state? And secondly, what is the fiscal cost to the state, as the chairman even just alluded to? There's seasonal employees that even the state and local units of government hire, but have we got a fiscal note back that says raising the minimum wage here will cost the state nothing? Because I know out in my district, the DNR hires summer help at some of our state parks. And while I'm not exactly sure what their wage is, my hunch is they're maybe not minimum wage, but they might be $9 or $10 or $11 an hour. And if we're raising the minimum wage here, there has got to be a cost that will be driven up. And I think we ought to at least know that. And so can you provide the committee what salary costs the state is going to incur by your bill as a second part to my question?
Well, thank you, Mr. Senator Westrum and Mr. Chair. It's my understanding as this bill, we had this conversation as we've been developing this, that a lot of those workers that you're talking about, the seasonal employees, the youth, those folks are exempted from the minimum wage. And so as I have looked at it, and I'll continue to take a look at it, but it's my understanding as we stand today, and maybe we can also get some help from our friends from Dolly, that there is not a cost relative to the context in which you put the question in.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, can you point to the exact language in the bill or the amendment that's going to give us relief or exempting state government from the bill that's going to affect all other private businesses and local units of government? What line are we talking about gives us an exemption?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wester, Mr. Rutkowski's here, and I think he can help us kind of wrestle through what is, I think, a pretty good question, Senator Wester.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Westrum, the fiscal note from last year was attached to House File 92. This is a Senate bill, and the Senate last year in their minimum wage bill, which was House Senate File 3, Senator Eaton's bill, did not include an annual adjustment for inflation. So that's why this is new to the Senate. But when we did the fiscal note last year, there was, I believe, only a few servers at the Douglas Lodge at Itasca State Park who made the minimum wage because that's what servers make. So it's a very small amount, maybe five people, I think.
So Mr. Chair, Mr. Rutkowski, are you saying that the fiscal note process discounts or doesn't include any pressure of other wages that might have been above minimum wage before but now will either be below or closer to what minimum wage, the new minimum wage is? There's clearly got to be a recognition that somebody that was making $10 before with a new minimum wage of $9 or $9.50 is going to have pressure to go up to $10.50 or $11 or some other number. Do we not count that as any fiscal consideration for the state?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, in short, management and budget did not contemplate that. You'll hear from testifiers who, and to the members, there has been a lot of testimony on this, and a lot of people do say that it pushes up wages, but that's nothing that MMB could calculate with any certainty.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just ask you, you're quite the fiscal hawk. Would you subscribe to that theory that there will be no pressure on any wages close to the new minimum wage or that are below after we get a new minimum wage? I just think everybody that's got concern has nursing homes in my district, for example, have raised this concern over and over to me. But, Mr. Chair, I would question the fiscal analysis of what we're doing in this committee and in the Senate if we're not considering that as a fiscal cost to the state budget down the road.
Well, Senator Westrum, you might recall, and I guess Senator Lurie's not in the room, but in his bill, there was some money provided for nursing homes to take into account what might happen. And so, at least relative to the nursing home situation, I think that's something that has been addressed. And you might recall that was an ongoing part of the conversation since last year.
But, Mr. Chair, we're talking out of both sides of our mouth is what's going on with state government, because we just heard from the Department of Labor and MMB doesn't consider this. We've got the chair of the HHS committee that's adding money into his bill because he knows this pressure and problem will exist with employers that are out there. And so I guess my question is to you, who's right, the testifier in MMB or Senator Lurie, who's accounting for some of the costs. I don't think.
Well, they're both, Senator Westrum, they're both correct because the agency is not, Labor and Industry does not deal with what happens with wages in private industry, whether it be a nonprofit nursing home or a for-profit manufacturing plant. So they're both correct.
But Mr. Chair, either I'm not explaining myself very clearly or you're maybe ducking the question. My concern as a finance committee, we oversee all the finances so they balance for the state in the end. And if there's a fiscal cost to a bill that goes through here, you've been quite a fiscal hawk in wanting those dollars covered or accounted for or paid for. It seems pretty clear that we are going to have a impact on the state budget, whether it's HHS through better reimbursements to nursing homes or DNR, who hires a lot of summer staff for helping out at boat landings and state parks and you name it, or PCA, who hires summer help or anything for surveying. You go down the agencies, and what is the impact to those agencies on the salaries that they pay some of their staff? And that's the question I have.
Okay. Well, and Senator Westrum,
it seems to me we're ignoring that cost.
Senator Westrum, a couple of things. And I want to make sure we have the opportunity for testimony in a minute. But Senator Westrum, a couple of things. First of all, it's not uncommon, and you've seen it, everybody's seen it over and over again, where an agency feels that they can absorb a particular cost. Second, Mr. Murkowski works for the Department of Labor and Industry. He's not somebody from management and budget. And so I don't think it's quite fair to put him on the spot relative to what happens to other budget agencies, since that's not the responsibility for labor and industry. So
Mr. Chair, maybe MMB is here and could address. He referenced MMB that they hadn't. So I assume what he was telling us was accurate. He's a good man, and I've known him for a long time. I don't think he would mislead us, Mr. Chair. But MMB can maybe come up and confirm or deny what was said as part of the testimony.
If there's somebody here from MMB who would like to testify, I'm not seen anybody.
And Mr. Chair, I guess my point is I'm puzzled as to your willingness to overlook this glaring cost that we should at least recognize and address, whether it's reducing the $750 million reserve to $740 or some other number that reflects it. That's I guess what really is baffling me.
Senator Westrum, it's been my understanding, again, I've not been close to the issue, but it's been my understanding that agencies affected, and keep in mind that's a handful of agencies, it's not the entirety of state government, that the agencies affected feel that any change can be absorbed within their budget. You know, because if you're talking about not a huge number of workers within a particular agency, say if they're seasonal workers, it's been my understanding that they would be able to absorb that. But why don't we, if we could, I made the offer for testimony, and I don't know how many folks would like to testify, but you've been there for, I think, the last hour and a half, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ben Gerber. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We're an organization of 2,300 businesses across the state of Minnesota. I think, just to start off, to address Senator Westrum's comments, I think even some of the, actually a lot of the studies on this issue and most of the ones, especially from the left, from the, I think it's the Center for Economic Policy and Research, which is a left-leaning think tank, acknowledges the issue of wage compaction and the fact that as you raise up these other wages, you're going to see people who might make a little bit above minimum wage now, they want to see a commensurate bump. And when we're going to almost a 50% bump, you're going to see those impacts in state budgets. And I think, more importantly, from my perspective and private industry, I think, you know, I know that process arguments fall pretty flat around here, but I think it's important to note that I have a lot of businesses that would have loved to testify here today, but getting a notice, I think even at 6 a.m. this morning, they weren't able to make it. I actually, on the way in, got an email from a friend who happens to run a manufacturing business for her family, and they're actually not chamber members, but one of the interesting things that she said, surprised, you know, the email said she's very surprised that they that there's this agreement. And in their manufacturing facility, they have 10 young adults that they employ as part of a work training program for young people with disabilities who are done with school but need to get jobs. They produce at about one-third the rate of a typical worker, but they believe it's socially the right thing to do. Their concern from a raise like this is for all these other small businesses that do this across the state of Minnesota, what are they going to do? They're going to have to pay somebody a 50% higher wage that produces at one-third the output. It doesn't work out. The math doesn't work out. And that's what the business community is has been trying to say all along, that these, especially when you look at our wage rate and what's being proposed here in comparison to the surrounding states, every other state around Minnesota is at federal conformity. We have not opposed a move to $7.25 an hour, which is federal conformity, but going above that, we have opposed as a state chamber of commerce. I think there's a lot of issues in here that haven't been vetted by the Senate. The Senate has never, to my understanding, taken up in a committee hearing the price deflator or the indexing provisions. And I think these are problematic from our position. I think what I'm really concerned about, too, is, you know, I'll pick on Senator Hayden because he's sitting next to me, but, you know, we haven't had the opportunity to talk about what's going to happen to the businesses in his district. So I've talked a lot about with Senator Hayden about the Midtown Global Market. I mean, the impact that this is going to have on a struggling area of the state, specifically that area, to go to 950. I mean, and I'll mention, too, one of the things that we're seeing in the service industry is we're moving to self-service, to things like the fast casual restaurants, and you're seeing that become an issue. So I think to not have this vetted, to have the public hearing and to have that advance notice, I think is really problematic beyond just the policy issues, which everybody in this room has heard the chamber talk about in our opposition to going above federal conformity. And with that, I'll stand for questions.
Mr. Gerber, just a couple things. First, it's relative to the process. I want members to note that Mr. Gerber made a reference, if I understood you correctly, correct me if I did not, that you received an email about 6 in the morning relative to a proposed settlement. And that person would have heard about this and would have had apparently some knowledge about it before many members, most members, maybe not quite all members, but most members of the majority caucus in the Senate. So in terms of process and so on. And Mr. Gerber, this might be a little bit unfair, but because obviously you haven't been with the chamber for the last, you know, 50 years or so. Has the chamber ever testified in support of an increase in any minimum wage?
Mr. Chair, I would actually say we have. I just stood here right now and said we support an increase from 6:15 to 7:25. So we are supporting an increase. Our position is that when you go above and beyond the federal rate, it's especially worrisome when you look at our region. All our surrounding states are at the federal rate. Some of them have other provisions excluding certain industries that I know are not in this bill and we're not asking at this time. But so we have testified in support of them, and we are. And I'm standing here right now saying we do support the move to 7:25, but not anything more.
Senator Ingebrigtsen was next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure who had asked the question to, either you're the author, but you talked about, and Senator Hayden, you talked about staying with the times since 1973, I believe you did. Mm-hmm. And has there ever been any numbers kept track of, or maybe the chamber can help with this, of those that actually went above the minimum wage and actually paid more than minimum wage since 1973? Do we know any of those numbers at all? Because I hear from both sides that we need it, and also that, you know, minimum wage is not an issue for me because I've been paying higher than minimum wage for years, and I don't have to. So are there any numbers out there floating around that can say or tell me as a policymaker that in fact some of the areas there's not been a problem because they've actually gone up by themselves? Do we have any numbers like that?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Engelbretson, you know, I do have some notes about just kind of the times that we're in, and you know, I'd like to read a little bit to it. I don't know if it'll get to your specific question, but in terms of a technical one, but, you know, a full-time worker, 40 hours a week in the U.S., make a minimum wage, earns about $15,080 a year. For some context, the medium individual earner earns about $40,404, and the poverty level is at about $23,000. If you put that, full-time minimum wage workers make 62.7% less than the medium income and are 36% below the poverty level. If minimum wage kept pace with productivity increases, it would be closer to $20 an hour, and the annual salary would be about $41,600 higher than the U.S. medium. If the minimum wage kept with the earnings of the top 1%, it would mean it would be higher than $22, and that'd be about $45,760. And that's just for context. I don't know if that answers your specific question, and I can certainly try to get that, because, you know, you can't anticipate what everybody would say, but that's some of the notes that I have relative to what's been going on over the years.
Mr. Gerber, maybe you could comment on that, and also what Senator Hayden talked about, the productivity increases. Is that something that, you know, that's configured in here somehow, or that has not been configured or figured in? Or please comment. What are your comments with regards to the ones that have been giving the increases without the heavy hand of government coming down and saying you will?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingridson, thank you for the question. I think to respond briefly to Senator Hayden, I think that's really problematic. You're comparing apples and oranges. I hear this a lot on the productivity increases. I mean, that's taking into consideration over the last 20 years, cell phones, computers, which have kind of revolutionized the workforce. So those, when they use those numbers, they're not talking about just the human productivity. They're talking about the mechanization and the technological revolution in our workforce. So I have problem, believing that statistic. I know a lot of people have jumped on that. I think it's really, you know, misleading. I think, you can pick any date in history and inflation adjusts the wage and find a political reason. I mean, we hear it was 1968 or 69, because that's when it had the highest buying power. Actually, the first minimum wage, 1938, I think you've all heard me say this. If you inflation adjust it today's dollars, it's 413. So, I mean, there we go. We pick a date and we find a different number. So I think it's problematic to just keep picking different dates and then inflation adjusting it and saying that we're not high enough or we're too low. I think one of the things that we've seen through the Dolley data, which again, why I think it's important to take public testimony and hear these issues, is the further away you move from a minimum wage increase, the less people you have making a minimum wage. So the last Dolley study that came out, I think it's every 2 years, we had 93,000 people making minimum wage, and I think now it's 83,000. And again, because this was quick, I usually have the study with me. And so the further we move away, the less and less people making minimum wage. I think there was a federal study that just came out that we have the fewest people making the minimum wage in our country than ever in history, because the further we move away, the businesses adjust, people, we see wages go up. I think that's the problem with continually going back and forth. I have a copy right here. So I think these statistics, and again, why it's important that we have these hearings and to vet these issues, is that it shows something different versus inflation adjusting it. You're going to have this this increase year after year when we already see, I think it's 2/3 of minimum wage workers get an increase in the first year that they're on the job. People move up the ranks, and that's how the private industry works. And I think this is why it's problematic to take this and then to continue, especially with the inflation adjustment.
Thank you. And just one more comment, Mr. Chair, if I could. And then there's been some talk about compromise. This is the compromise language, and this is something that's been agreed upon. Well, we all know about the time frame now. We've been talking about that for the last 45 minutes. Quite frankly, I didn't think I was even going to be at this committee today. I was the lead over at Senator Tomasoni's committee, and when you're the lead, I guess my priorities would be that I have to stay over there with those particular bills, which generally doesn't happen too often. You have two finance committees going on at the same time, but nevertheless, we did that, and then all of a sudden we broke for this particular particular committee meeting, and frankly, I was not planning on being here at all. So the folks need to understand that the compromise we're talking about here is not a compromise which I think Republicans and Democrats are actually going to come up with. In fact, I think it's fair to say the word out there was that everybody knew somebody was we were going to agree on a compromise, and we were going to agree on something to move forward here. I think that's pretty evident by Senator Dames' bill that's been floating around, and that we were willing to work. But understand, the compromise we're talking about in this committee is Democrat compromise only between the House and the Senate. It has nothing to do with Republicans and Democrats, and that's really unfortunate, Mr. Chair. And it's further more unfortunate, I think, that we are once again now within the last week two different bills, two different instances where we're dealing with something that doesn't really cost the state of Minnesota a whole lot of money. Actually doesn't cost any money. We don't have a fiscal note on this, and we're not prepared to even look at this, and we're moving forward. So I have to convey my sentiments here as well. I think this is just a compromise Democrat, and you can call it what you like, hoodwink closed doors or behind closed doors or even behind locked closed doors. The bottom line is this has not been being brought to us. We're not even able to vet it. Information is being dropped off with the testifier right now, right in front of us all, and we're just forging right ahead. The public needs to know that we're doing this without any bipartisanship. It's just not happening.
Other questions for Mr. Gerber? Senator Bonoff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gerber, you mentioned that the chamber supported federal conformity, correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, that's correct.
Okay, so right now the administration in Washington is going around and getting testimony, having public meetings around the idea of moving towards 10-10. So, when you say federal conformity, is the chamber really saying federal conformity? Mm-hmm. So that if that occurred and that happened federally, that would be something the chamber then would be on board, because we think it's important for our state to conform with the federal minimum wage?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, thank you for the question. The Minnesota State Chamber is focused on state-specific issues, so that would be an issue for the federal chamber to weigh in on. I can guess what they're going to say, but we tend to draw a pretty strict, bright line between state and federal issues, and I think, again, the reason why our state, compared to surrounding states, this would put us way out of compliance with what these other states pay.
Well, Mr. Chair, and I guess your answer speaks for itself, but again, your rationale for why you support federal conformity is because you think it's important that there be a consistent standard, and so it seems to me that in terms of talking about you can't have it both ways, that those are questions that should not just be asked but should really be answered as well.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My first question would be to Senator Hayden.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Gerber?
I will be asking him some questions. Senator Hayden, you gave a list of benefits that would be typical of benefits to workers if this was passed. 365,000 workers would be affected by this in a positive way. 63% would be women. The minimum wage would maintain itself, meaning that the legislature no longer needs to debate about minimum wage ever again, because we'll be following an inflator, and that, of course, will be recognized by a commissioner, and therefore we don't have a whole lot of work left to do on this ever again. But the question I have, since you've done such a good analysis of the benefits of this legislation, tell me, what impact will it have on the business community? After all, your bill will be a government-imposed cost increase on the private sector. So could you tell me what kind of impact you've done research on that would affect businesses in the state of Minnesota? And if you could break it down between large employers and small employers like your bill suggests, I would greatly appreciate your analysis.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, I appreciate it. I'm not usually in the when I do bills to to start to negotiate against my own bill, or at least start to say what I think all the things. I think that the positives outweigh the negatives, as I've outlined. I know that there is some suggestion that, for instance, 99% of the people will be, or a great number of people, and I'm looking for the page here, would be affected by this, and that there would potentially be a small group of people that may not. I think Mr. Gerber probably could help you with all of those questions that you have. And so from my perspective, I have not done this analysis or don't believe that business is going to be affected, that the sky is not going to fall in and that everybody's going to leave. I know we hear that a lot around here. We got great information, and I won't bother the committee with that about if what we do and our tax policy makes us better or worse than our neighboring states. And then there's all of this information suggests that we have a very good business climate. So I do think that this would be helpful to small business. I think it would be helpful to its workers. I think it would increase sales and revenue for small businesses. Those are the things that I believe. I'm sure Mr. Gerber and others that don't like this issue. I do want to say with Mr. Gerber, because he picked on me a little bit, I want to kind of just give him back that we both like to go to the Midtown Exchange that's in my district, and he does, and he goes, and he provides to the local economy. I also would hope that some of the great people who work for his organization can come and help us do an analysis as to how we can increase productivity. I think that that would be great, because I know that he likes the Midtown Exchange, and so do I. But once again, Senator Limmer, I think that there are that the things that are going to help business are going to outweigh the things that are not. I'm sure that there is a whole group of people who continuously will always, including Mr. Gerber and the folks that he represents, that says that this is going to be bad for business. I just don't believe that.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, what I hear you saying is you don't know if there's going to be a negative impact on businesses in the Minnesota when we, by law, increase their costs. Mr. Gerber, do you have any comment about whether or not businesses will be affected in a negative way if government increases the cost of business in this manner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, thank you for that. I think what's really frustrating about this is you hear a lot of rhetoric that says, well, there's going to be, you know, $300 million or X million dollars of new spending. And I really want to, you know, it's a rhetorical question, but I will answer it. Where do you think that money comes from? That money just doesn't appear out of nowhere. And where it comes from is other middle-income, middle-class workers. And that's what I think is really problematic about this bill. And that's what the issue of wage compression is that people at the middle end up not getting raises or they don't get that promotion that they're up for, even though they're coming in to work and working really hard. That money comes from somewhere. It doesn't just fall out of the sky. And I think that's what's really problematic, is it doesn't create new spending. It's a different version of the spending. I will agree with that. But it's not new money that's coming into the economy. And I think that's what's really problematic about such a drastic increase is where is that money going to come from? And then I think as much as we've been attacked, or my organization's been attacked on, well, the sky is falling and nothing ever happens, I would say that the opposite is true too, that none of the things that were promised from these large increases I don't think come to fruition. And I think, unfortunately, what ends up happening is we see more and more businesses leave, and we have seen that.
Mr. Chair.
Especially small businesses.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Gerber, having run a business myself, owned a business myself, oftentimes when I have a increase in costs, I have to do one of two things. Either I have to raise the price of the goods and services that I offer to the public, or I have to cut back on other expenses. Now, there's been a lot of labor analysis on minimum wages over many, many decades, and it always seems to come down to the same fact that if your minimum wage is increased by a government fiat, that means that you're going to have to raise the cost of your goods and services, or you're going to have to lay people off and make do with fewer people in your workforce. Now, some businesses can economize. Some, they might be a little heavy on employment, but they're putting and offering jobs to a greater number of people in a community. This forces employment to shrink, especially when we're not in a strong economy as it is. We can only rely on so much government borrowing on the federal level, and that's just going to make this country a little more risky, and the cost of the use of money is going to get more and more expensive. We're already beginning to see that on the mortgage market, where interest rates are beginning to rise, primarily because this federal government continues to rely on record-breaking debt. And so this type of a minimum wage increase, although I think there is broad consensus for some kind of minimum wage increase, an inflationary factor, an autopilot inflationary raiser, as well as a high cost of raising minimum wage by 35% over the next 2 years, is a bank breaker. And that's what's going to happen in the state of Minnesota if this passes.
Any further questions for Mr. Gerber?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this question is for Senator Hayden and Mr. Gerber. I've been, as we're discussing this, I'm trying to go through the bill. And in three places I see at line 3.35, there's a clause that says no employer may take any action to displace an employee, including through reduction in hours in order to hire an employee authorized by this paragraph. I have had a number of employers from my district come in and tell me that, look, if you increase the minimum wage, the first thing I'm going to have to do is begin to reduce employees' hours. So can Senator Hayden and Mr. Gerber, tell me what you believe those lines mean in that no employer may take any action through reduction of hours. Is there a prohibition in this bill that will prohibit an employer from reducing an employee's hours in order to comply with the mandate of payment of the minimum wages outlined in this bill?
Good. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, and I was making sure I got all of your question. It's my understanding, and I was speaking to Council Mr. Fuller, that this is already in current law, and if Mr. Fuller would like to come up and talk about the provisions and how it got there, that would be great. I also invited Mr. Ruscha. I know that Mr. Gerber has now planted himself next to me, so I wanted to make sure we had the other side and the experts there as well so that he didn't just dominate the discussion, Mr. Chair. So,
okay. So, Mr. Fuller, did you want to?
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, if you look at page 2.16, you'll see that currently in the training wage, that language is there. But it's not there with respect to the general large and small employer. It's there in the places you put out the special conditions where they're allowed to pay less than the standard rate. And so the policy is that you do not jettison employees when you're allowed to pay sort of a substandard rate. So you saw those three, the J visa, the under 18, and the training wage. But with the training wage, that law was already in effect. So it continues that policy with respect to these new other classes of subminimum wages. Well, they're not subminimum, but they're lower. They're for small employers. But I must point out that if they're covered by the federal government, federal law, the higher of the two always governs. So you know that.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could have Mr. Gerber comment on my question, I specifically am interested in whether or not there's any prohibition in this bill that will prohibit an employer from reducing existing employees' wages in order to comply with the mandate of increasing employees' wages.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, so I would agree with Mr. Fuller's analysis. It's only talking about the exception. So under the other lines, so 2.1 beginning there and I think ending 2.13, with the small and large business wages, there's no prohibition that you couldn't reduce somebody's hours, and I think that's what you're getting at, because they wouldn't be able to afford to have such a a large payroll, or for various business reasons, which I think we believe will happen, where there will be layoffs. The CBO report acknowledged it as well. And I also wanted to clarify something I said earlier that the chair picked up on. The email, I went back to check. The email came from a Star Tribune alert at 6:45 in the morning. I don't know. It wasn't I actually didn't receive anything from the Senate about this hearing, I think, going back to the process issue. But so it was actually the Star Tribune that reported that, not actual official Capitol email.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Gerber, thank you for that clarification. Any other questions of the testifier? Senator Nenow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll ask this, Mr. Gerber, but Senator Hayden, if you want to chime in as well. The way we have a tiered structure for large and small employers. And serving an ex-urban district, I've got a lot of those employers that are going to be right in that edge there. Your restaurants in town and things like that. And I was just crunching some numbers to see the kind of pinch point that we could have. And I just want to get your comment, Mr. Gerber, maybe you, Senator Hayden. Just two examples of maybe Main Street North, I've got a restaurant cafe on one side, and Main Street South, I've got one on the other side. And one of them is a restaurant doing $13.65 a day in food sales. And the other one is a restaurant doing $13.85 a day in food sales. So one of them is a small employer, one of them is a large employer. Let's just assume 10 FTEs, keeping the math simple. That means that the restaurant on the northbound side of the street is going to have roughly $40,000 a year more in cost compared to the restaurant across the street. How does that restaurant stay competitive when their competitor across the street can pay $40,000 a year less for business cost?
Senator, Mr. Gerber.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Nenow, the issue with this, and this was actually brought up, I brought in a small business owner to talk to some of the senators on this issue, and $500,000 in gross sales made, exclusive excise taxes at the retail level, even for the smallest businesses in very rural Minnesota, is not very much if you're going to have a payroll and a few employees. And so I think that's the problem. I mean, the small business owner that I said, I don't remember exactly the number of employees, but she had like $580,000 in gross sales. So she would be under the large business wage, and by no means is I think she said her net off of that was about $8,000. Granted, she owns three businesses, so, but I think that just shows the problems with the bill, is that the $500,000 in today's economy, just very few businesses. I think it's important, but I think to maintain, but I think from the practical reality, we're actually reducing it from $625,000, which I think is problematic as well. So we're reducing the number of small businesses. Another issue that hurts small businesses in this state that we see in this bill, and that I think unfortunately will make very few small businesses qualify. And I think then there's the problem of if you can pay your workers, if you are able to utilize that wage, which I think very few businesses will, then you have the issue of can you still compete with the same workforce and pay them less. And I think that will be an issue that we'll see go across, especially greater Minnesota, where I think this provision will be problematic.
Mr. Gerber, I recall you earlier saying that the chamber would support an increase up to 725. Can you tell the committee about how many people would benefit from that, from your proposal of $7.25 increase?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the analysis that Dolly did with 83,000 people said those are who are paid the federal minimum wage or less. So it's somewhere in that number that are paid at 725. I actually asked for but was not able to get, and I know Mr. Rakowski is here representing the department, what number within that 83,000 were paid below 725? And there are various, as you know, in the current bill, there's a training wage and things like that. What percentage of that workforce was applying complying with that? And I they didn't have the numbers. So I just know that there's a number of 83,000.
Senator Nenow, I know I jumped right in, but do you have a follow-up?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I'm very flexible, Mr. Chair.
I like flexibility, you know that. Senator Nino.
Senator Hayden, I'm going to direct this. It's a new version of the same question, but I'm going to direct this one to you. And unless you think I'm focusing on narrow, tiny little pinch points, which are real for real people. I mean, if you've got that kind of competitive disadvantage, you're going to go out of business. You're not going to exist. But here's the practical reality for many, 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 many more businesses and many of the businesses in the district that I represent that utilize the lower wage, lower skilled employees, because my district borders Wisconsin. Now, you take a look at the Chisago House in Taylor's Falls. It's a nice little, it's a beautiful town. You should go there. It's a good food at the Chisago House, and you can enjoy the riverboats and everything.
Yeah, I've been up there. It's really, it's Mr. Chair, so you know, this is a great place.
While we were sitting here, I just did a little Google mapping and took a look. And across the river is the Dallas House in Wisconsin, 0.9 miles away, literally 2 minutes. And you're looking at a $40,000, $50,000 a year competitive advantage for businesses that basically provide the same service.
Border County study.
How are they going to do that?
I don't have it, but I know it.
Well, Senator Nino, so are you directing that to Senator Hayden?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hayden.
Senator Nino, you know, I think we can talk, you know, in hypothetical terms, and I think that, and I don't mean to be demeaning of your question. I did bring Mr. Ruscha just to as we start to debate, and I think that he is familiar with the border study that has started to wrestle with some of those issues, and maybe we can, Mr. Chair, hear from him a little bit. I know that we have a lot of work yet left to do, but I think it's important to start to be able to articulate some of the things that we think are positive about this bill.
Well, thank you. So identify yourself for the record, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Brian Ruscha, and I'm one of the co-chairs of the Raise the Wage Coalition. We're a coalition of over 60 community groups, mostly comprised of faith and labor and nonprofit organizations in Minnesota that have been working for a couple years on this minimum wage issue, and are very relieved and also very happy about the agreement that's been reached that I think meets the principles that we set out, but also does it in a way that's reasonable and addresses some of the concerns that were raised by the business community around the state. The first thing that we organized around was the idea that no worker in Minnesota should work full-time year-round and be poor and meet the and not be able to meet the poverty level. In 2014, this year, the poverty guidelines for a family of three would require a wage of $9.52. So we're even off a little bit, but we're making great strides in this bill, which is why we support the agreement. To Senator Nienau's point, and I think that's why Senator Hayden asked me to jump in here, the definitive study on that comes out of University of Massachusetts Amherst. Author's name is Dube, D-U-B-E. He did this massive border county study. He looked at counties across the nation where one state changed the wage and one state didn't, and noted that there was very little employment effect. And the simple reason for that is because most of the industry, most of the jobs, the restaurants, employers are in sticky businesses where people decide to go to that locale, and they make that decision. It's not something that is all that movable, if you will. So I just wanted to point that out. It was a massive study. And, of course, when Minnesota changed, it looked at, like, you know, the Wisconsin-Minnesota differences, or when another state, it always looked at the border counties and looked at employment differentials.
Senator Nina, follow-up question?
Well, if Mr. Gerber has any comments, if he knows anything about the border study, I'd be interested to hear.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. I think there's probably two studies. Mr. Ruscha is addressing a metadata study, which I would say, quite honestly, aren't worth the paper that they're printed on. They're studies of studies. And there's a lot of them on both sides. I think they're very misleading. They look at the data, and they don't actually get down into how the studies were performed. The one study that is often cited is a study that looked at a wage increase. I believe it was Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania and New Jersey, and it looked at going from 425 to 525, so something like a little bit of a 25% increase. Again, I'm not a math major. This is a – no study has ever looked at a border increase at such a dramatic level that we are talking about here. We're talking about a significant increase, especially when you consider that we are surrounded by states that are all at federal conformity. So I think it's really dangerous to base this premise on a study that looked at a difference in New Jersey and Pennsylvania about, I think it was 10 years ago or over 10 years ago. I think it was in the mid-90s when it was done. It might have been 95. So I have a lot of reservations about relying and making such a large decision on a study like that. One, on a metadata study, and then two, on a study that looked at a much smaller increase on a very different – I mean, you think about the East Coast, and then you look at Minnesota. We're bordering Wisconsin, North Dakota, South Dakota. You don't have to go very far to look at the difference between the border cities. You drive up to – I spent a lot of time going in between Fargo and Moorhead, and there's a big difference between those two cities. And I think a lot of it has to do with what we're talking about here.
Now I am unsure, and even though we can continue to debate this issue, but I think we should adopt, or at least do the adoption of the A6, and so the bill still will be before us. So if you want to continue your debate, we can do that. But I naturally assume that Senator Sieben renews her motion to adopt the A6 amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Generally, you debate the... We have the motion in front of us, mm-hmm. and that's what we're debating. So you're moving for a vote on the amendment?
Only on the amendment. I would like for there to be a vote on the amendment. Senator Fischbach. Okay.
Mr. Chair, like I said, generally you debate with that in front of you. You're debating the amendment right now, so you debate with that in front of you. So you're...
We are debating the A6. If there's anyone else who wants to speak to the A6 amendment, even though they can continue to debate the underlining bill because it is a delete all, we can do it either way that you like. But I think based on time, and I think that we've heard a number of comments around the table, I would like for us to at least decide what we're going to do about the A6 amendment and still allow people to debate the underlining bill and make any amendments that they would like to do to the underlining bill. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, then I'd call for a roll call on that.
Okay.
Vote on it.
All right, roll call has been requested. A roll call will be granted.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. I did have Senator Bonoff who had a question. Would you like to raise it now, Senator Bonoff?
Mr. Chair, it was with regard to the debate, so I will withhold that.
All right. Senator Westrom?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I would just encourage anybody that still has debate on the amendment. I mean, what if we go to 1050 or 850 or some other number in the amendment that might change how somebody would vote on the amendment? So I would encourage you to have committee members and testifiers all finish their testimony towards the amendment because that in itself, to Senator Fischbach's point, would or could change, which ultimately could affect members' votes on whether they want to adopt the A6 amendment or not.
I'm going to do whatever the committee wants to have done. My rationale is simply this. This A6 is a delete all, which means that even if we adopt it, it's still the underlining bill, and anyone can make any amendments that they want and continue to debate it if that is what they would like to do. Any questions? I'm open for, you know, options, but I think that that we should make a decision about the A6 amendment. All right. So to the amendment itself, the A6, all those in favor? A roll call has been requested. The chair votes yes.
Anderson.
No.
Bonoff.
Yes.
Cohen.
Yes.
Dibble.
Yes.
Fischbach.
No.
Goodwin. Ingebrigtsen.
No.
Latz.
Yes.
Limmer.
Nope.
Laurie.
Yes.
Miller. Newman.
No.
Nino.
No.
Pappas.
Yes.
Peterson.
No.
Saxog.
Yes.
Sieben.
Yes.
Stumpf.
Yes.
Tomasoni.
Yes.
Westrom. Weegar.
Yes.
Goodwin. Miller.
All right. To that, we had 12 ayes and 8 nays. The A6 amendment is adopted. Now to the underlining bill.
Mr. Chair.
Discussion on the bill for the minute. Senator Westrum.
Mr. Chair, just to the recent testimony, I forget the gentleman's name, but Mr. Gerber and Senator Hayden, we talk about the effect it has, and Senator Hayden, I think you referenced people say the sky is falling and it doesn't. Members, I would just bring you to a case in point, and it's in my district. It's on the western edge of the state. I border North and South Dakota with my Senate district. At a very engaging conversation with the mayor of the city called Breckenridge. Thank you, Chris. Across the river from Breckenridge is a city called Wahpeton. He informed me 50 years ago. He's a business owner in the city as well. And we got talking, and he said, it's interesting, 50 years ago, Breckenridge was the big city. Wahpeton was the small city. In 50 years only, that has reversed completely, and Wahpeton is multiple times bigger than the city of Breckenridge. And so I think to the testifier, and to Senator Hayden, I would just show you case in point. And I think there's other border city communities you could go around this state and see the exact same issue that goes on. And for us that represent communities that are near the border, these get to be major issues. My Dairy Queen owner in Breckenridge is going to be under a new set of regulations that he has to deal with than a similar restaurant across the border in Wahpeton. There's a reason this flip-flop of the two sizes of cities that the mayor talks about has happened in less than 50 years. Last summer, if our decisions here don't have significant consequences. Another example, we raised the cigarette tax. My border communities, within the first month, saw the purchase of cigarettes drop up to 50% in their stores. And incidentally, when people go to get cigarettes, they oftentimes will grab a gallon of milk or fill their car with gas. And that is a issue they are still dealing with. And so I represent them. I bring their plights and stories to you because they are real. It's not fiction. It is something they have to figure out how to deal with or where they're going to expand. And as the one of my owners, who's also got stores in South Dakota, told me last summer, we are not looking to expand any more stores in Minnesota. We can go elsewhere and make more money, or at least have a better chance of recovering what we invest. And so, Senator Hayden, I'm talking on behalf of my constituents and my communities, but this is not fiction. It's real. You can come out to our areas along the borders, and this is reality.
Senator Bonhoeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Westrum, thank you for those comments as well. I just want to make sure that we're talking about the bill before us rather than the theoretical, because Mr. Gerber made the comment about the dramatic jump and that the border states were, for the most part, federal conformity. And so I want to remind members that the bill before us, and so given federal conformity is 725, the bill before us does go in stages, and so the first line on 2.5 says $8 per hour beginning August 1st, 2014. And so the jump is not to 950, as some discussion has intimated. And then also with regard to some of the carve-outs, I just want to make sure members understand that we're still actually, with this proposal, we're under the federal wage with our training wage, our youth wage, and now the new provision as well, the J non-immigrant visa holder. So I just want to make sure that as we debate it, that we debate what's before us.
Okay. Do we have further discussion on House File 2091? Senator Peterson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, there's been a number of references to seasonal workers and how they're exempt from that, and I've been having a hard time finding that in the bill. Could you point us to the line and number there? And then I have some questions about who that actually applies to.
Hey, Senator Hayden.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, I think I want to look to some of our staff to help us out about the
Mr.
provision
Fuller.
That's in current law that I think is what we're referring to. And then with that, I do want to make sure, because I really respect the committee and their time in this institution, that sometimes we get a little hyperbole about the sky is falling, and I wasn't trying to discount anyone's real anxiety about the work that we do, especially those that live in Senator Westrom's district. I know that some of those cities have been in the enterprise zones and others where we've tried to even that out. So I don't want, for the record, for anyone to think that I was being disrespectful of some of the concerns that folks have all across the state. And I just want to make sure people knew that. But Mr. Fuller, I think you can help us with the
Mr.
question.
Fuller.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, I think we should remember that under the labor standards, federal labor standards, it's the higher of the two laws. Both the federal and the state define employees and have a multitude of exemptions. So with respect to the state law, the exemptions are found in the definition section, which applies to this section, which is 173.23. So there's a list of about 19 different classes of workers who are not considered employees, hence not required to be paid the minimum wage.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, or Mr. Fuller, I guess one of the things that comes to mind is, for example, the state of Minnesota is in the golf course and ski hill business at Giants Ridge. The taxpayers own those businesses, and they compete with the private sector, and they hire temporary workers to mow the grass and temporary workers to, or seasonal workers, not temporary, they're seasonal, to run the lift operations. Are those folks exempt from the minimum wage as a seasonal worker?
Mr. Fuller.
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson. All right, I'm going to go through the 18 right as fast as I can here in my head. Number 5 on 177.3, subdivision 6, the definition of employee. We're talking about state law. Okay. Any staff member employed on a seasonal basis by an organization for work in an organized residence or daycare camp. Okay. On number 13, for the any individual employee, well, that's for overtime. So for overtime, it's any individual employee in a ski hill. So they're not exempt then from the minimum wage or a ski facility.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Any individual under 18. I'm sorry.
I just said to follow up that Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, or Mr. Fuller. The other thing I'm thinking about is you know, one of the jobs I had in college was a staff member at a group home where I watched over underage kids, and I slept at the group home. And so I got paid a different wage while I was sleeping because I was sleeping along with the residents of that home. Is there any adjustment for, I guess, the health care maybe is the way to describe it, for people that are on, say, a 24-hour shift or a longer shift where they're actually sleeping, or are they getting paid the full wage amount during while they're sleeping as well.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I believe there is. I can't cite it right now. There is a rule about people who sleep as a personal care attendant, and I can't cite it for you. Maybe Mr. Rakowski remembers it. I would say in the bill itself, there's three provisions that are pertinent to your question. The three provisions that relate to paying less than the standard minimum wage is for a large, it's actually the same as a small employer. That's the training wage. So if you're 90 days and under 20, it doesn't matter whether you're a seasonal worker or not. If you're under 18, no matter how many days you work, it doesn't matter or not if you work for, so it's across the board. And it's also across the board for a J-1 visa holder, of which I'm, you know, those are non-immigrants coming over, so that's a different case.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. With that, I'd like to offer the an amendment to the amendment. It's the A8.
So at this point, there'd be an amendment to the bill.
Okay.
Yes. We've adopted the amendment.
Yep. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It'd be the A8 amendment to the bill.
Okay, if we could have that distributed.
Members, as this is being distributed, what this bill does would eliminate the inflator. I think in light of the border issue discussion that we've had and in light of the budget discussions we had just last session where a number of northern Minnesota manufacturers were exempted from the new energy requirements, for example. Members, I would ask you to consider that in just a few more short months, probably next session, we're going to have bills coming forward looking to exempt certain counties, certain areas of the state from this issue, specifically relating to these border issues. We have many of those things in law right now relating to property tax, for example. And by eliminating the inflator, I think is going to put us in a situation where those border communities will be treated much more fairly than they would be under this existing bill. And, Mr. Chair, I'd ask for a roll call on this amendment as well.
Okay. We have Senator Peterson's motion. The roll has been requested. All those in favor for the amendment? Senator Newman?
Roll call, he said.
Mr. Chairman, to the issue of this automatic inflator, I don't remember hearing any kind of explanation as to, you know, how it's going to work. I notice there is some language on the bottom of page 3 about a subsequent minimum wage rate can be calculated and given. I wonder before we vote on Senator Peter's amendment, if we could have Senator Hayden and maybe Mr. Gerber come up and give us their thoughts on how this automatic inflator is going to work and maybe give us some explanation as to what it's going to be based on. And I say that principally because I had read earlier the language in the bill regarding this automatic inflator is candidly kind of confusing. So I wonder if we could have some testimony on that, Mr. Chair.
For a couple of minutes, I thought we had had some discussion earlier, but Senator Hayden?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Newman, I'll read the language and see if there's questions. Beginning September 30th of 2017, the Commissioner of Labor and Industry shall determine the percentage increase based off of the implicit price deflator for personal consumption expenditures. The increase is capped at 2.5 and may not decrease the rate paid. The increase shall take effect if January 1st, 2018, and then be conducted annually, therefore using the data from the 12 months prior. The commissioner may determine not to enact the increase for 1 year if the leading economic indicators including but not limited to GDP projections, CCI, and seasonal adjusted Minnesota unemployment rates indicated the potential for a substantial downturn in the economy, et cetera. So I think that is how it would work, and that's what they would do. I would ask the committee to not vote in favor of it. I think that part of the one of the discussions we've been having in what I've said in my testimony, and maybe I know Senator Newman has been there, but to reiterate it, is we think it is an important value because we have lost track in people's buying power and their and the rate that they have without having this inflator means that people lose over time. And so I know that Mr. Rushi is also an expert in that. I want to ensure that though we know that Mr. Gerber has one opinion, we also have others. But to that point, I just think that this is a good policy to move forward so that we so that people aren't losing their buying power over time.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Hayden, I appreciate the fact that you have read to us the language in the bill. And this is not a gotcha question. This is a sincere question that I do not know how this particular inflator works. I don't know what the criteria is. I don't understand the mechanism. I can read the language. And so I'm really not trying to put you on the spot. I am looking for an answer as to what that language means, what is the criteria, what is the mechanism. And if we have staff that can comment on it, Mr. Chairman, that's perfectly fine. I would also ask that Mr. Gerber comment on that language.
Mr. Gerber.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, so I think the question is specifically on the implicit price deflator. I think we still have very serious concerns about the implicit price deflator. We had even greater serious concerns with the CPI, and I think another reason why we heard a lot of people talk about, well, when you inflation adjust something, they're usually using the Bureau of Labor Statistics Consumer Price Index, which even the federal government through the Boskins report has said, I believe that came out in the mid-90s, that it overestimates inflation by about 1%. So the price deflator is a better, but it's still a very bad mechanism to use. And I think the frustrating part from the business community and is that we elect, and I think from the greater voting population, we elect senators and representatives to come here and debate issues. And we think setting things on autopilot is especially dangerous, and especially in this issue. I mean, this is why we elect people to represent us. And we're now delegating that authority to a mechanism that the federal government comes up with. I think it's problematic. It doesn't look at county by county. It doesn't look at, I believe that it's the nationwide. So it doesn't impact just what's happening in Minnesota. And again, that's why we elect people in Minnesota to represent us, because they understand what's happening in our state. But to explain the mechanism, it analyzes consumables. And so I think the analysis that's often used of why it's a better than the CPI is that 10 years ago we didn't have iPhones. And so that created a whole new market and a whole new use of goods that wasn't seen in the economy. And so the price deflator accounts for that a little better. But, again, it's still a dangerous thing to set this on autopilot.
Senator Lurie?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Newman.
Thank you, and then I'll be done. I promise. I just want to make an observation that this automatic inflator that we're talking about, if I read the bill correctly, is giving the commissioner, i.e., the executive branch of our government, the authority to implement this automatic inflator, as opposed to having folks come back to the legislature and have the legislature have us look at whether or not we should impose or enact an addition or a higher minimum wage. And just the fact that we are having this rather lengthy discussion today on whether or not to enact an increase in the minimum wage tells me that it should not go with an automatic inflator with the executive branch making the decision. Rather, it should come back to us so that we can have that discussion. And if we pass this bill with the automatic inflator, it seems to me that we have once again delegated our duty or our authority and our responsibility to the executive branch. And that, I believe, is to the detriment of our constituents. Okay.
Mr. Rushy.
That's okay, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Lurie. I don't know. How many economists we have in the room, but Mr. Nauman, you had a little bit of help to offer us.
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm not an economist, but I guess we're going to play one a little bit today. So in response to
Senator Newman's question. I did a little unpacking of the difference between the CPI and the gross domestic product, so this will suffice as probably as close as we're going to get today, unless there happens to be an economist in the room. So the consumer price index is one of a variety. I mean, we talk about the consumer price index as a single measurement, but it's really literally thousands of different indices. We tend to use mostly the consumer price index for urban consumers. That tends to be the typical one that people talk about, and it's a measurement of a basket of goods over time. And it's produced by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and it's an attempt to measure the changing prices in the overall economy over time. I think it goes all the way back to 1913. That's as far back as I could find data. The gross domestic product, the implicit price deflator, by contrast, is a slightly different measurement, and that measurement is allowed to change based on people's consumption and investment patterns over time. So, for example, the example that I saw referenced in a paper while you were all were talking about something else is, if the price of chicken relative to the price of beef goes up, the implicit price deflator will recognize that there might be a difference and an increased purchasing of beef relative to chicken to recognize that price change. So it tends to recognize those relative differences within the basket of goods, but I should hesitate to quickly say it's not a basket of goods. It's an attempt to measure the overall economy as opposed to just the basket of goods that's in the CPI. It tends to run, based on the analysis that I saw, about a third lower, but that's on average. So you can find years where there is substantial differences.
Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to echo some of the comments Senator Newman made in that, and you've heard me give this speech before, I find it concerning, I was going to say problematic, but concerning is a better word, that the legislature, at least of late, has tended to cede over its authority and give more and more power to the executive branch. And if you read the legislation and read what's in there, it's more than just the commissioner using this implicit price deflator and all these numbers and finding out what the rounded up to the nearest penny or wage increase should be. When we get to the point where we're in some severe troubling economic times, the authority is in there, and Senator Hayden said this, it's not on autopilot. The commissioner can put a halt and say, no, we're not going to increase minimum wage. That's a bad idea right now. But then what happens is that increase gets banked. And later on, and it could, as I read this, I don't read any kind of limitation. It just says in a year following. It could be 100 years later. So we could have a 5-year depression, 10-year depression, and the commissioner says, no, it's a bad idea. We don't want to force wage increases when we're trying to get people back to work. You could have 100 years later where someone decides to draw from the bank and rack up the minimum wage based on what we didn't do 100 years ago. And those are the kinds of things that the legislature should do in the context of what is going on in Minnesota. This is and someone referenced this earlier, and I don't remember who it was, maybe Mr. Gerber. This is a national number. And the time will come when that number is out of sync with what's happening in Minnesota. That day will come. It may not be in our lifetime, but that day will come. That is why we elect legislators to come down here and debate these things from a statewide, regional, Midwest perspective. I don't really care what's happening out in New York relative to what our minimum wage is here. But New York, what's happening out there, now will affect our minimum wage in some fashion. And I guess all of that to say, Mr. Chair, that I think this is a good proposal to take this out of the bill because this is what we should do. It is ceding over legislative authority to the executive branch, and I've given this speech before, but I just could not give it again.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate your patience. You know, as we're talking, I'm reading the bill, and down on the bottom of page 3.34, and this is, I think, a question that is relevant to the amendment that's before us. Could I get an explanation, Mr. Chairman, as to what the language beginning at 3.34 does in terms of the commissioner being in a position to make a supplemental increase in addition to the automatic inflator that is discussed at paragraph F? Is there someone who could give me an explanation of
Mr. Chairman?
What that supplemental increase is and how does it play into or conform with the automatic inflator that's at paragraph F?
If there's anybody who can...
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Rushi would like to take a shot at Mr. Fuller is also here to help us.
Mr. Chairman, that's considered, I think, the catch-up clause, that after one or two or many years of not increasing the minimum wage because of an economic downturn, then the commissioner has the ability to do something more than 2.5%. Otherwise, the bill caps increases at 2.5%. It basically says you don't have to follow the 2.5% if you can do the when you do the catch-up. But it still is catching up to what the implicit price deflator would say would be the adjusted minimum wage. Now, in a downturn, I would venture to guess that that increase in the implicit price deflator is going to be very, very, very small.
Mr. Chairman?
Sir Newman.
Is there a possibility then that there would be two increases in the minimum wage in any calendar year?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think so. Because it's directing on a timeline when the commissioner is to certify and when he has to issue that and when the comment period is, and that's an annual process.
And so the answer to my question is no.
No. Mr. Chairman, no.
Thank you, Mr. Okay. Chairman.
All right, we've got Senator Peterson's motion in front of us. Senator Peterson, did you ask?
For a roll call?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Okay, so we have Senator Peterson's motion. If the clerk will take the roll, the chairman votes no.
Anderson.
Yes.
Bonoff.
No.
Champion.
No.
Dibble.
No.
Fishbach.
Yes.
Goodwin. Ingebrigtsen.
Yes.
Latz.
No.
Limmer.
Yep.
Lori.
No.
Miller. Newman.
Yes.
Nino.
Yes.
Pappas.
No.
Peterson.
Yes.
Saxog.
No.
Sieben.
No.
Stumpf. Tomasoni.
No.
Westrom. Uyghur.
No.
Goodwin. Miller.
Okay, on a vote of 8 yes and 12 no, the motion is defeated. Are there further amendments to the bill? If there are no further amendments, Senator Sieben moves that House File 2091 as amended be recommended to pass. On that, Senator Fishbach. Roll call requested by Senator Fishbach. The clerk will take the roll. The chairman votes yes.
Yeah, thank you.
Anderson.
No.
Bonoff.
Yes.
Champion.
Yes.
Dibble.
Yes.
Fishbach.
No.
Goodwin. Ingebrigtsen.
No.
Latz.
Yes.
Limmer.
No.
Lori.
Yes.
Miller. Newman.
No.
Nino.
No.
Pappas.
Yes.
Peterson.
No.
Saxog.
Yes.
Sieben.
Yes.
Stumpf.
Yes.
Tomasoni.
Yes.
Westrom. Uyghur.
Yes.
Goodwin. Miller.
Okay, a vote of 12 yes, 8 no, the motion does pass. Thank you very much, Senator Hayden.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
So members, if we could continue to pay attention, we have Senate File 2214, Senator Champion. Senator Latz moves adoption of the division report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before us is a bill that has been worked on by a number of different people. One is over the interim, we had a task force or commission, for lack of a better word, that came together both from the Senate, cross-section of folks from the House, came together in order to look at this issue of expungement. We also had some great support and help from law enforcement, also from the County Attorneys Association, Council on Crime and Justice, just a broad coalition of supporters and folks who help, you know, shape the bill that is before you, which is Senate File 2214. On a global level, what it does is that it creates an opportunity for an individual who is seeking to have their record sealed or for purposes of, you know, employment, housing, and the like, they would have an opportunity to have their record sealed while balancing the opportunity for law enforcement, county attorneys, and others to still to have access to those records and still be able to do their work. That's what this bill boils down to. Mr. Chair, I could go through the individual provisions if that's what you would like for me to do.
Sure. Why don't you explain the bill, Senator Champion? And should also point out that we have a fiscal note. Senator Champion, you had mentioned this earlier, but it's been reconfigured. So members will recall we're tracking the cost in Senator Latz's article or on the spreadsheet, but the recommendations coming from Senator Latz's division. But there has been a reduction in the fiscal note we have. Let me just have Mr. Nauman comment on that for a second.
So, Mr. Chair, I think I'd be a little bit more comfortable if Mr. Turner were actually to speak to the price differential,
okay,
because he did most of the work on that.
Mr. Turner, if you could just comment, and then we'll go back to Senator Champion.
Mr. Chairman, members, Chris Turner, Senate Fiscal Analyst. The fiscal note you have in front of you is Senator Champion is tracking all those costs but one, and that is for the BCA. It's got a cost of $832,000 with the tails of $784,000 a year. Senator Champion sat down and talked with the Department of Public Safety and the people of the BCA, and they came up with an agreement that they thought they could implement the bill for $600,000 a year.
And so, Mr. Chair.
Nauman.
So the tracking in Senator Latz's bill shows the $600,000. I believe we're also carrying the $98,000 and vamping quickly the $34,000 associated with the bill. So those are already booked in the bill we processed last.
Right. So, Mr. Turner was.
Mr. Chairman. Members, real quickly, yes, there's two appropriations in Senator Latz's article of your finance bill. One is $600,000 to the BCA, and the other is $98,000 to the Department of Human Services. Then we're carrying $34,000 in federal financial participation reimbursement. And there's one other thing that shows on the fiscal note here. It's a $159,000 revenue loss. In the original bill, Senator Champion expands the number of people who are able to get expungements, but they were in the original bill. The civil filing fee was waived. That was not the senator's intention, and so in the division report, you'll see Section 6, and that took care of the court costs. We went back to current law.
Okay, thank you.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Turner, can you explain the local cost? Take me through that a little bit, how that's computed.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, could you tell me where you're looking?
Mr. Turner, I was kind of looking for guidance from you on that very issue, actually. They'll say that it does have a local cost. That's what I was wondering what it was. Better understand what the local costs are.
I don't see a local cost. Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, they do have, they check the box in public safety that there is a local fiscal impact. That's on page 18, although I don't know what that local impact would be.
And we have someone here from the Department of Public Safety that can speak to that.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Dana Goetz from the BCA, and I think that was an error because on our current fiscal note, we do not have local impact checked, and I'm not aware that we ever included local impact.
So Mr. Chair, the question would be there would be no local impact then, apparently. Thank you.
Uh, Mr. Chair.
So, Mr. Chair, I have...
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Senator Champion. I just had a quick question for Senator Latz in terms of the chair of the Judiciary Committee. There, it does appear that there's a significant cost to the Supreme Court. Did you have a concern over that at all, or on this expungement?
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, this bill came out of the Judiciary Division. We considered all of that, and we're fine with it.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Champion.
No, we were just going to speak to that, but Senator Latz is correct. We have looked at all the costs. All the costs have been accounted for, and we also make sure that the judiciary budget stays balanced. And with that, Mr. Chair, I have one amendment that I would like to offer, which is the A6 amendment, and I can talk about why we're offering it here.
Okay, if we can have that distributed.
Now that the majority of the members have the A6 amendment, let me explain the A6 amendment. The A6 amendment comes as a result of my conversations with Senator Brandon Peterson. He's also a co-author on this bill. In Section 7, we provide access to these expunged records to county attorneys as well as to law enforcement and also probation for sentencing purposes. And in that, by providing this access to law enforcement, Brandon or Senator Peterson was concerned that if we allow the allow law enforcement to have access to these records for criminal investigation purposes, that they do not take those records and start building their own database. And so with that, we came up with this language in order to make sure that it's clear that any expunged record received shall be destroyed when the investigation becomes inactive or the record is no longer needed for the purpose for which it was obtained, because they have to articulate to the BCA as to why exactly that they are seeking that record. And that's the only difference here. So I would stand for any questions. Other than that, I was moved for adoption of the A6 amendment.
Okay, Senator Champion has moved the A6 amendment. Is there further discussion? Sir Limmer.
Mr. Chair, I thought that in the Judiciary Committee we discussed whether or not records would be available for law enforcement. Does this amendment change that general view that once expunged, the records would be destroyed? Is that what this is doing?
Senator Champion.
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, no. So law enforcement would still have access to the record for the articulated purpose. Once that purpose is no longer needed, the law enforcement officer who received it must, you know, get rid of that record, but the record is still available through the BCA. We just don't want law enforcement or anyone else to compile all these records and start their own private database that would be in violation of our intent.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer,
would this run in conflict with confidential investigative or intelligence files that a law enforcement agency would be collecting otherwise?
Senator, Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, no.
Mr. Chair, the only question since I've gotten those two answers, I would find it might be difficult for law enforcement, or I would think that it might be confusing for law enforcement officials to separate the two. If they suspect an individual is doing something, they're compiling evidence, reports, observations in the community. They have a record that sometime in the past that individual might have been in similar activity in the past, but now they can't hold it. I guess I'm thinking that some confusion might occur.
Mr. Chair and Senator Limber, I don't believe any confusion would occur, because if you look at lines 1.5 on the amendment, it clearly says the investigation becomes inactive or the record is no longer needed. And so that is that protection language. I have also had an opportunity to run this by law enforcement, and there appears to be no challenges and no problems with this.
Chair, who was the law enforcement officials you visited with?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I've been talking to the County Attorneys Association, who's been also working with law enforcement, because that was the arrangement that we would all work together under those that process. But what my commitment will also do is allow them again to take another look at it, and then if there's any concerns, then we will deal with it later.
Mr. Chair and Senator Champion, so the County Attorneys Association has approved this language as articulated in the A6 amendment.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, yes, with the caveat that we'll continue to look at it and make sure that we continue to run it up the flagpole, for lack of a better word.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
A couple things, and I see the County Attorney Association is here. Maybe they would come to the table and testify one second, if you would. And also, Senator, I'm wondering why maybe I'm misinterpreting the amendment, but why would law enforcement want to gather and stockpile data if they have access to it all the time?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, it was just a concern that was raised by Senator Peterson, and this was comfort language just to make sure that everyone was on the same page, and they would have access to it because they would have to, you know, go through the process. But it was something that he was concerned about, and I wanted to make sure that I was being responsive to his concerns.
Mr. Kingery.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, John Kingery speaking on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. I believe Senator Champion did discuss this verbally with one of our folks a couple hours ago. I'm seeing it for the first time now and would certainly want to run it by the two individuals that we worked with in coming up with this language. You know, words like shall destroy cause me some concern. I want to make sure we understand what we mean by becomes inactive and no longer needed. But we'll work with you in addressing any concerns that we would have.
Okay, we have Senator Champion's motion on the A6 amendment. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion carries. Division. Division's been requested. All those in favor, please raise your hand. And opposed?
You're voting no?
On a vote of 9-6, the amendment carries. We have the bill in front of us. Is there further discussion on the bill? Senator Anderson.
Chair, there's in our packets a SS-2214 division, looks like an amendment.
It was amended in division.
The division report we adopted at the start.
You adopted already?
Yeah. Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, Senator Champion, I just was made aware of a concern from the Department of Education and some of the school groups who are concerned that teacher background checks may be an issue. I was working on some legislation earlier this session to ensure that all school employees, if they are involved in a incidence of sexual misconduct, that school districts would be able to get that information for the purposes of hiring. Are you still working on that issue, or is there anything light you can shed on that for my information?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben, yes, we have some language that we are working with them on that we're going to accept because we understand their concerns, and they have given us some language, and we're working on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. There's no further discussion. We have Senator Champion's motion that Senate File 2214, as amended, be recommended to pass. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.